Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Become a paid subscriber, get access to ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
Wow, you must have amazing dinner parties. She had this incredible laugh, this giddy, slightly disconcerting laugh. Her name was...
Martha.
But all I could think was, if all of this is true, then why can't you afford a cup of tea?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen, here today with Patrick Lepik. How's it going today, Patrick?
Was that good?
Nicely done. That clip from the beginning was from the Netflix original series Baby Reindeer, the first four episodes of which we'll be discussing today. We'll also be covering the latest episode of The Sympathizer. But that's going to be after we get to a little bit of television news. You can find more episodes of this show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. We're also posting on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram. At decodingtv is our handle on those platforms. Patrick Lepik, Decoding TV has been running for many years now, but this new format in its current incarnation is still very young. You know, we're only in under 20 episodes with this
almost
new
like
format.
A little baby reindeer, David.
That's right. Like, and because we're so young and inexperienced, occasionally we may make mistakes on the show. I know it is shocking, but last week on the podcast we discussed the curse. And the cover story in the Hollywood Reporter, and we mused how, hey, Emmy voting's not going on right now. Why would there be a random story about the curse? Other than that, the journalist who wrote it, Seth Abramovich, probably was really into the curse. Well, a couple people wrote in correcting us that even though Emmy voting does not begin until June with the nominations announced in July, it is currently heavy on in Emmy for your consideration season. So eligibility for Emmys lasts through May. So this is typically the time when people like to remind Emmy voters that their shows exist. So the curse being a cover story in the Hollywood Reporter, not odd at all. And definitely a time where, hey, like this show aired 5 months ago. You want to get the word out again before people vote in Emmys. I still think that what we said about this journalist being really into the curse is true. Hard to justify a cover story unless you're super passionate about it, in my opinion.
Sometimes you get assigned, like if you're a journalist, like sometimes there are stories you're pursuing because this is something I'm interested in. And there's other stories where your editor is like, hey, we need this written up. That story, that cover story, which both you and I read front to back, really felt like somebody in the weeds on, like they cared.
Yes, they
about
cared.
The curse.
They cared. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, wanted to mention that. Yeah, Emmy voting doesn't begin until June. Nominations in July, and also we talked to Patrick about how the Emmys aired super late this year. That was obviously because of the strikes. They will theoretically they're supposed to be in the fall. So
the timeline does make a lot more.
Yeah,
sense.
Yeah. This will probably be the shortest amount of time between Emmys we've seen in quite some time. So it'll feel kind of weird and redundant, my guess, is when the Emmys happen later this year. But anyway, wanted to just get that correction on the record. And obviously, we're all still learning, and accuracy is very important to me on all of my podcasts. So thanks to everyone for writing into decodingtv@gmail.com about that topic. Okay. I wanted to mention, by the way, speaking of decodingtv.com, you can always become a paid subscriber and support us. Patrick Klepek and I are really starting to get into a groove of the bonus episodes. I'm feeling great about the bonus episodes that we have planned and that we're going to do. And I mean, planning is a strong word, but there's a lot of stuff that we want to discuss that is going to be on the bonus episodes. We recently chatted about Invincible Season 2, Part 2. That's a bonus episode available to paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. And also, you know, Patrick Klepek, there is a show on Apple TV Plus called Sugar. And right from the beginning of that show, so the way it worked is they released all episodes for critics before Sugar came out on Apple TV Plus. And a lot of people watched all the episodes of Sugar and said, wow, this show is pretty good, except something happens in episode 6 that completely changes your perception of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, huh. Well, that's like a time bomb that's going to go off in 6 weeks. because, yeah, like, it is actually quite the lead time between when critics got those episodes and then when the episode actually aired was quite some time, you know, like 5-6 weeks later. So because they're releasing that show episodically. So anyway, episode 6 actually aired this last week. I have watched the entire season of Sugar just to talk about it on Decoding TV. Patrick Klepek watched episode 6. Just so we could get what his perception was as like a person, you know, coming into the show with no context. And we are going to talk about that on our bonus episode this week. So if you want to hear that conversation, which I anticipate will be quite amusing, become a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com. So thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who's a paid subscriber. And yeah, wrapping up the bonus episodes, and it should be a lot of fun. But the paid subscribers are who help to keep this podcast going. All right, all that said, Patrick Klepek, let's talk about just a couple quick items of TV news this week before we get into our conversation about The Sympathizer and Baby Reindeer. First of all, Gen V, a very great television show that was about to go into production in the very near future. And unfortunately, Chance Perdomo, an actor on the show, passed away tragically in a motorcycle accident in March. And so there's a lot of questions about like how the show is going to continue to function. Will the show continue to function? What's going to happen with that character?
And major crossover with upcoming seasons of The Boys. Like the idea was that the shows were going to ping pong off one another. And if you, without getting to spoilers on Gen V season, there are very concrete sort of reasons to see, I see how these things are going to overlap between these two shows, despite how siloed they are for the vast majority of at least Gen V's first season.
The Gen V X account posted this week from the producers of Gen V, as we continue to navigate the tragic loss of Chance Perdomo, everyone at Gen V is determined to find the best way to pay respect to his memory. We won't be recasting the role because no one can replace Chance. Instead, we have been taking the time and space to recraft our season 2 storylines as we begin production in May. We will honor Chance and his legacy this season, end quote. Just wanted to let people know that that's what's going to be happening. Like, they're not going to recast the character. They're going to figure out a way to deal with that character's passing or absence on the show. And I just think it's kind of interesting that we, like, the way that shows are communicating this kind of news these days, people clearly have really intense connections with not only the characters but also the actors that play them. And I think they needed to say something. Like, people were wondering, you know, like Gen V was a great show that people loved. The Boys season 4 is coming out in June, and so I think they needed to say something. And it's a very respectful post, I think, and like was received very well. But it also just makes me think, like, we live in an age where this kind of post feels necessary almost. You know what I mean? Like 10, 15 years ago, something like this happens and a new actor shows up in the role and people don't really talk that much about it. But now I think it's a very different environment, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder about that. Obviously, the people's personal connections to the characters, to the actors is, as you said, very indicative of the culture we're in. You know, we saw this no more clear than with, you know, Chadwick Boseman and Black Panther and the decision to not recast that character.
Yeah.
I think in retrospect, that was a bad decision. I think that character probably should have just
artistically and creatively, but you're saying
I, yes. Yeah. Yes. I 100% completely understand where it came from, especially the way that news came out in the middle of COVID, out of nowhere, right before that movie. But it's all just to say, I do think there is something about the culture we're in now, yeah, the parasocial relationships that audiences have with the people who make the culture and the entertainment that they enjoy. I respect the creatives. This coming so close to production, in the same way that Chadwick Boseman, like, is such a shock. Like, how can you make, you know, rationality, irrationality? Like, there's so much that goes. But I do wonder, in a world where what's best for the stories we're telling is that, you know, finding a way to continue, you know, is there a way to honor the actors while continuing? It's a very complicated question. And I don't know that you can separate the parasocial relationships from, like, if they chose to recast, well, does the backlash to that, like, end up, you know, distracting from the stories they're trying to, you know, I don't know. Again, right. I'm deeply sympathetic to all parties involved and how these decisions arrive at it. But the further we've gotten from Boseman's passing, I do, like, my gut inclination is usually like, I understand why we don't do these recastings, but I wish they'd gone a different path with the Marvel stuff, and who knows what'll happen here. Maybe it'll be just fine. But I mean, this character was as main character as you get. Yeah,
it's a critical part of the show.
Yeah, like
I think it's interesting. First of all, there is some pushback on this post. You know, like overwhelmingly, I think people are very positive about this. But I think there some people are saying, "Hey, you know, he was playing a character, and now if that character is not coming back, like that character will never have their arc."
Right.
I think it's just so, it's become so thorny and complicated because A, you're right. There is a possibility of backlash from the audience. They're like, how could you so callously recast this character? But also, it also feels to me like the actual cast themselves might have a backlash. You know, like, I think when they decided not to recast Chadwick Boseman, like, everyone was very supportive of that and like honoring his passing. And I will say, like, that was some of the most emotional parts about Black Panther 2 was
absolutely was
how they honored the passing of T'Challa. And but I think like the cast was a part of that, you know, they like there's an energy on set and there's an energy of this collaborative environment that as a creative person managing that you don't want to mess with. And if you're like, hey, by the way, this person who you felt like was a family member, well, guess what? There's a new person that's going to replace them. It's like, yeah. It really kind of can change the vibe in a way that is unpredictable. And so,
yeah, and I don't mean to be dismissal of any of that. I just,
but I think it's a relatively like new dynamic. Cause I think,
yes,
you know, decades ago, like, I don't think we would have, you know, or maybe the dynamic was still there, but we just wouldn't have heard about it as much. Right.
Correct. Like,
And now we hear about it. It's all out in the open now because everyone has Instagram accounts, everyone has X accounts, whatever. And so it's just fascinating to think about this thing. Obviously, a very tragic loss because this guy was young dude, super talented, part of a hit show. But I am very curious to see how they will honor his memory and his legacy. And I'm guessing they're going to do a really good job. So we'll see how that plays out. In The Boys and in Gen V. But wanted to mention this news. Another piece of news that came out this week, you posted this. Cobra Kai final season will be split into three parts. This is about Cobra Kai's final season, the 15-episode final season, which will drop on July 18th, part one, and then part two, November 28th. Then a finale event sometime in 2025. Patrick Klepek, have you been watching Cobra Kai by any chance?
I haven't. I don't have like a real nostalgic connection to the Karate Kid films, but I've heard that, and it's not, Cobra Kai doesn't seem worth watching unless you like have that part of it. But I've heard it's very good for the people that like adored those movies, or at least that original film growing up. But I was chuckling watching the trailer for this. Because like part one, part two, part three, it's like at what point are you essentially just doing like the Netflix version of it's? I think this is the Netflix version of a weekly drop. Like it's the closest they're ever going to get to doing something weekly.
I don't know. This feels more like Netflix's version of splitting up Breaking Bad season 5 into two parts.
But
or
three? like two, like I, as far as I know, we haven't had a three-part split up. Like I understand I could be, I think it was right. The audacity to go, because Stranger Things did this as well. Like, it's very normal these days.
Right, right.
It's why it goes all the way back to like Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, part one and part two. Why? The quest for more money. You know what I mean? Like, it's
well, the Sopranos also did this, I recall as well. Like, they split, because essentially it was like, my sense is that later on in the show, people who make these TV shows are navigating a bunch of different priorities. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to minimize costs, but like, they're paying these actors and creators kind of more each year as the time goes on. And so there's like, instead of two seasons, how about we make one extra long season and split it into two parts? That's often what happens with like shows that are really successful that go on for a long time. And I think that's, you know, it's happened with Breaking Bad, happened with The Sopranos. And so this feels kind of like more like that to me than a kind of episodic release. If you want to see what Netflix's episodic schedule is, the reality TV shows they do often have a really good job of this, where they'll drop a batch and then it's like new episode every Friday. Or with Love is Blind, they'll drop like four batches of episodes over the course of a month. And that feels like a pretty good balance to me. But mm-hmm. You're right. This is notable in that it's like, hey, two seasons, many months apart, and then one third part that we're not even going to say when it's coming.
What? Out, right? All I could think about watching this is the biggest, like, kind of axe to fall at Netflix in terms of like a long running series that is like very quickly near is Stranger Things, right? Like, a defining era of Netflix is in the modern, like, Netflix is Stranger Things. And we are nearing the final, there'll be spinoffs, yada, but like, the show is ending. And then they can figure out if they can pull off a House of the Dragon, like Game of Thrones later. But like, Stranger Things is coming to an end, probably not till next year because of the strikes. But all I could think about watching this trailer was like, when the first trailer for Stranger Things drops, like, they'd be like, part one, part two, part three, part four. And I'm like, are you just doing a weekly drops over the course of a month and calling it a 10-part, like, the like Stranger Things season 5, the anthology? And it's just like, you make it seem like you're doing something really different than just episodically releasing them, because it makes me very curious what they will do with what is, you know, one of their mega shows, like one of the ones that they have that like the world stops on a dime for. Cobra Kai is very popular, but I feel like Stranger Things has a cultural dominance that is rare air for anything else on Netflix. And so I just, I'm like, how are they going to resist the temptation to not turn that into more than three parts? Like, I expect them to up the ante by the time we get there. So that's all I was kind of thinking of, was like, I really don't expect Netflix to ever go full weekly, because that's kind of against the business model they've built. But like, when you have these events, right? Like, when you have these event shows, what do they do with something like that? And so I eagerly await the trailer for Stranger Things season 5.
Yeah, I just wish there was a little bit more thought in general from all the streaming services in terms of what's released weekly or what's released binge style. You know, like, I feel like we put in more thought into like how we're approaching it than a lot of studios. Fallout being the great example of, you know,
I heard a great theory on this. Julia Alexander used to work in video games, now works over at somewhere I believe called Parrot Analytics, does a lot of consulting and analysis on TV and streaming and things like that. She had theorized on a podcast I was listening to called Downstream that Amazon is participating in television upfronts for the first time this year, and that the reason Fallout dropped all at once was because the best way to have the biggest, hottest numbers right before your upfronts is to drop the show that you're confident is going to be big all at once, because you end up with a huge number right away, and you don't have to worry about what the tail is on those numbers, because all you're worried about is that $65 million number that you're going to then put in front of advertisers.
Viewers,
yes. Yeah. And that, so entire, she was like, it's entirely possible Fallout season 2 follows the Boys model of, you know, two or three episodes and then weekly for the rest of the season. But that as Amazon does this big pivot into advertising, they wanted this big number. And I was like, oh, that makes some sense. But even if it makes sense when someone who is an expert explains it to me, like how they arrive at it, it doesn't solve it for you or I or the average person going, why would they do something like this? Because it just feels wild and arbitrary.
That does make sense. So the chain of events is Amazon decides that it's going to make Prime Video into an ad-supported service or an ad-driven service. Then, as a result, they're going to be presenting at this thing called the upfronts, which is where companies present their wares to advertising companies other companies that in hopes of getting their advertising. And then they drop fall all at once to have a good number for the upfronts. I have no knowledge as to whether or not that is actually what happened, but it seems like a very plausible.
The logic makes sense, especially because the fact
like basically a decision made 18 to 24 months ago that has nothing to do with the artistic quality of the show ends up driving the release schedule of the show. Very possibly. I don't know though. I will say I do have friends who work on the Amazon Prime Video ad product. I am curious, Patrick Klepek, what has been your experience in the new Prime Video ads?
They've been fine. You know, when Fallout puts the ads at the front, and then
I've
seen
the ad load has been relatively manageable. Like compared to Hulu, you know, I feel like Hulu, you're getting interrupted every like 15 minutes.
Yes,
but for Prime Video, they'll show you like 1 to 2 ads up front, and then usually nothing. Oh, like very often it was nothing else until the end.
So there's nothing in Fallout, and I wonder if that was a sometimes you get it's like sponsored by this company, so that you don't have to watch ads for the rest of the way. I don't know if exactly how Fallout worked, but I watched. When they made this switch, I was like, I'm not gonna upgrade until I don't know, like a show really felt like it justified it. And I thought that was gonna be Fallout, but then Fallout had no ads after it started. I was like, well, I'm not gonna pay more for that. Invincible had, and I wonder if we'll see this more often as these ad tiers become more regular. Felt like it had pretty natural cuts, like scene cuts where the ads just slotted in.
Yeah.
Pretty naturally, where that was an opportunity where either I'd take a break from the show because I had to go back to work because I often watch stuff at lunch, or, I'm going to go do my dishes. Like, so I'm going to go like clean up my dishes from lunch while the ad plays, and then I'll sit down. And by the time I do that, I've gotten some more water and the show started up again. So I've actually found them to be relatively unobtrusive. And also, maybe it's because the age that you and I are at, like I'm just used to ads inserted into television. It's still like a relatively recent phenomenon that ads aren't in television. Whereas like ads in movies, like that would like drive me, like I would pay whatever amount of money I need to have that ad go away in a film. But in a television show, I don't know. It doesn't really raise my ire. I don't think I'd want it in, House of the Dragon or something that was very dramatic, but it worked for me in Fallout and what I've seen so far.
How do your kids perceive ads these days, by the way? I'm kind of curious about
shocked
that.
By them. So the thing about advertising with children is that companies don't do it. In many cases, legally, you are not allowed to advertise to children. Or if you run an ad business for children, the rules and regulations are so strict that most companies just say it's not worth it. So Netflix kids, for example, like if you switch over to their children's programming, no ads, even if you are on the ad tier of Netflix. And that is true for most services. And I sign up during the heaviest sports seasons, so like fall, winter, spring, for YouTube TV. And I usually cancel it during the summer for a couple of months. And my youngest was very into a bunch of stuff that was on Disney and Nickelodeon. She wanted to watch some new Paw Patrol show that was premiering on TV first, as opposed to just showing up on Disney Plus. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll record it on my Apple TV. And it showed up. And when we clicked play, there was an ad. And I couldn't skip it because it was on the DVR. And my kid's like, what's this? I'm like, that's an ad. She's like, I want that. And I was like, oh, I don't like this. I've gotten very used to when we go to a store, that's when they're being advertised to, right? Like they go to a toy aisle or something like that. But it actually made me sympathetic is the wrong word, but it's difficult in the new era that we're in for how children consume media. The traditional avenues to like introduce a product to them and that could be a trailer for a movie, a television show, a toy, whatever, is actually pretty difficult because there's not a natural point. Like, are they looking at billboard? You know what I mean? Like, where are they? Where are you even going to get the advertising to them? So
right.
my oldest just started. She graduated to being allowed to watch regular YouTube. It's still like regulated by age. So she's gated on a bunch of content, but there are ads there and she remains okay. I keep waiting for the day where she's going to ask, Dad, these ads are annoying. It hasn't happened yet, but I do know that YouTube Premium is probably on my list of things I'll have to get eventually, but they find them odd. Maybe not odd. They're charmed by them because they're just sort of strange. Like, I think my oldest called it, is this a trailer for a toy? I was like, yeah, that's that's one way to put it, kiddo. Because we love to watch trailers to get excited about like upcoming movies that are coming out. And so to her, calling it a trailer for a toy was just, I mean, I was like, you're dead on, like you're accurate. That's right. Just not what we call it. But
it's so interesting to think about. So they essentially are exposed to very little advertising mm-hmm. compared to us, at yes. least through the same avenues. Whereas I just remember spending, you know, literally 4 hours on Saturday morning watching cartoons and just mm-hmm. being bombarded by advertising nonstop. Right. Like,
yeah. I mean, I would say it's probably what is a lot of
on
times
a weekly basis. Yeah.
What they're watching is the advertising itself. Right. Which like the morning Saturday morning cartoons you and I were watching. I know you said there were lots of cartoon or ads in between the cartoons, but the cartoons themselves were frequently really just
also
veiled ads yeah. themselves. So we
had an ad load that was mm-hmm, probably mm-hmm. an order of magnitude higher in some ways, right?
I love Transformers, but I mean, many cartoons were toys conceptualized as toys turned into cartoons so that you would buy the toys. And so I think that pipeline still exists to a degree. It's just it's been disrupted in some really strange ways as we entered into the kind of on demand era. And then also, you know, I mean, actually, I mean, it's the increased regulation against like advertising to kids. Like, I think that's a good thing. Like, but I don't know that you should be advertising to children like broadly. So find another way to make them interested in things.
All right. Well, that's all the TV news I think we're going to discuss today. We got a bunch of other stuff to talk about on the podcast. But yeah, let's get into the part of the show where we talk about some specific television episodes.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So today on the podcast, we are going to be discussing the Sympathizer episode 4 and also Baby Reindeer episodes 1 through 4. And I want to let people know what we're going to be doing next week as well. Next week, we'll be finishing off Baby Reindeer season 1. So we'll be talking about the whole season. Talking about X-Men 97 season 1 in its entirety. Patrick Klepek, you've been watching this whole time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mainlined, I think, 8 episodes this last week or 7 episodes this last week. So I am also caught up. But we'll be discussing the entire season, spoiling everything, recapping everything. So if you've been following along with X-Men, you'll enjoy that conversation as well. And then we'll continue our coverage of The Sympathizer, which is more than half, like about to be half over at this point. So only 7 episodes of that show. But yeah, that's next week. Baby Reindeer, X-Men 97, and The Sympathizer, Episode 5. So let's get into it. Let's start by talking about The Sympathizer, Episode 4.
I told you this is Vietnam, right? So if you have to speak, let's do it in Vietnamese, okay?
I don't speak Vietnamese.
Wow.
Why doesn't she speak Vietnamese?
What? Why don't you speak Vietnamese?
Because I'm Chinese.
Was I talking to you? Okay. Hey, okay. I understand that it's a different accent, but are you able to make it sound Vietnamese?
Do you speak Danish?
Dude, just fuck us. Just swap Danish. Her out for an extra that speaks Vietnamese.
None of them speak Vietnamese. That's the thing.
None of the extras speak Vietnamese. I see. Did you know this?
I speak Vietnamese.
Are you an old lady?
Can somebody explain to me why I'm shooting a Vietnam War movie with Vietnamese extras who aren't Vietnamese?
All right, welcome to Decoding TV's coverage of The Sympathizer, Episode 4. Give us some good lines. Patrick Klepek, what do you think overall of this episode?
I knew you were gonna pick that clip as the audio as soon as I watched the show.
I watched that clip like 5 times.
I've seen you sharing it across different socials. Like, clearly that one hit for David.
It was so amusing. Anyway, all right. Go ahead, Patrick. What did you think of this episode, Patrick Klepek?
It's a great episode. It's a real swerve. Like, kind of feels like I don't know what the plot of this show is at this point. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what the arc of these characters are, but like, there's such a confidence and almost a swagger to the storytelling that I'm really enjoying. It's just this episode remarkably balances drama and comedy in ways that could be highly distasteful and offensive if done without, I think, the expertise and the sensitivity that's on display here. And it's a true joy to watch the show continue operating this way, because I started our episode going, well, I don't know what we're doing this episode. And by the end, you're like, well, I'm glad we did that. So just a truly fascinating piece of entertainment.
I think if I had to sum up this episode, it would be F Apocalypse Now, you know, like, or screw Apocalypse Now. Like, I haven't read the book, but I imagine watching a movie like Apocalypse Now, seeing all the praise and like acclaim it gets, despite how highly problematic it is. I can understand if you just want to be like, I'm going to write a chapter talking about how Apocalypse Now is terrible, you know, and I fully support that. That's great that we revisit this. Of course, in the show, it's not Apocalypse Now. It's a fictional film called The Hamlet that's directed by somebody named Nico, played by Robert Downey Jr. But I agree 100% with everything you said, in the sense that I think this episode by itself is amazing. Mm-hmm. It has so much to say about how different cultures are presented, how culture is made, how challenging it is to get authentic depictions of non-white people on screen, specifically not even non-white people, Asian people on screen in American media. But also, you're right that what is this show even doing at this point? Like, what are we doing? Like, what is the point of any of this? You know, like, where is it going? Because this is a real detour in terms of what the show was up to prior to now, right?
So, mm-hmm.
Who knows? That said, I thought this was an amazing episode. Like, I loved this episode so much. There's several sections where I rewatched it multiple times because I was like, that is such a good portion of the episode. Or a good section of the episode. And anyway, highly recommend The Sympathizer, Episode 4. Give us some good lines. Let's talk about what actually happens this episode. This episode begins with the captain meeting with writer-director Nico, played by Robert Downey Jr., to discuss the script for The Hamlet, the Vietnam-based film that he's shooting. The captain is the cultural advisor of the film, and he suggests maybe giving the Vietnamese character some lines. But the director is really not into it. He's into the raw nature of war. No words, only emotions. We got to start by saying, in my opinion, Patrick Klepek, this is the best Robert Downey Jr. character of the four characters, because it's the one I think that seems the closest to who he actually is in real life, and therefore seems like less of a put on That's my opinion. What do you think, Patrick Levick?
Yeah, if some actors have sort of a core like character they seem to be playing in a lot of their work, and then they deviate, you know, left and right, like based on what the character is asked to do. This feels like the most, like when you conjure in your mind,
right,
Robert Downey Jr. and like the kinds of characters he plays, like a lot of him is in this. And so it feels the most authentic relative to, I don't have to do any jumping through hoops. I don't have to like suspend my disbelief at all. It actually weirdly, despite the fact that it's the truest to Downey as I've seen him in other work, it's the least amount of work as a viewer that I've had to do to just be drawn into the character.
Absolutely.
Because I am not distracted by the costuming, the like the racism, like the weird accents. And I think all that works to differing degrees, but it was actually sort of nice to just, he's a great actor. And I think many of the things that go awry with the characters he's being asked to play really have less to do with him as much as what he's being asked to do relative to what he is capable of as an actor and the context in which it's being dropped. But here just feels like I'm sinking in with a terrific Downey performance that does like feel informed by the Tropic Thunder of it all. Like it certainly feels like there are like elements of that film being pulled upon in here in what's happening over the arc of this episode. But I'm with you broadly. Like this is the best that he's been in the show, and weirdly because it's the most authentic to the original Downey.
Right. Which, like, well, when you see him talk, like this is like very similar. He's not as big of a pretentious asshole as this character is, but it's like he's kind of on that spec. He's, you know, in that direction in terms of just his cadence and tone and style. So
it's like you know, if you've seen Oppenheimer, like that is the most subdued version of this kind of like Downey performance. And then here you have it, you know, dialed up to 11.
Yeah. Yeah. This scene is great. And throughout the episode, there's all this commentary on like why Asian characters get short shrift in Hollywood, right? That's kind of the thesis of the episode. And this part of the episode shows you that, oh, it's because like directors, A, they don't think Asian characters are that important or deserve speaking lines, but B, they kind of cloak it in these big ideas of, oh, like we don't need words. Like it's all about, I want the feeling, not the words, you know, all this, like all these big ideas, these grandiloquent ideas. And I thought it was just like a very smart way of tackling that. My favorite part of the scene was when he says mise en scène, like he calls it. He's talking about mise en scène, which is how you pronounce it in French, but he says mise en scène. So it's like, well, this guy has no idea what the heck he's talking about. And it's just an amazing depiction of how like oblivious and pretentious and up his own ass this guy is. Anyway, everyone in the captain's camp agrees that he should go work on this movie to represent his people. But given that he is a Viet Cong infiltrator, he's going to try to put in lines that honor his communist comrades. In the meantime, the general's daughter stows away in his car and smuggles herself onto the set. At the shoot, they meet the cast. By the way, amazing cast for this episode. Like you have like these actors who would headline a TV show just showing up for like one episode on The Sympathizer, right? James Yoon is a fictional actor in the universe of The Sympathizer. He's played by John Cho in the show. And Captain Seamus is played by David Duchovny, who is super method. Plus, there's an actor named Jamie Johnson, played by Maxwell Whittington Cooper. He is a TV star and singer. So at the sort of opening party, the launch party for the movie The Hamlet, Nico gives a speech about the film and how it will be an anti-war masterpiece and how it's great they were able to make it on the studio's dime. Couple thoughts in reaction to this whole setup. My mind was blown that David Duchovny was
same. I was so glad I didn't. Like, he turns his head around.
Yeah, it's like,
I'm like, are you?
What
we were just talking about X-Files on our podcast, and then David Duchovny just shows up. He also just doesn't act as much these days. You know, he had a long run. I forget that television show that he was on Showtime for a very long time.
Californication.
Californication, yes. And it's not that he doesn't still appear in, but he's pretty picky. He's clearly... Yeah.
He's not like a ubiquitous actor that's in everything.
No, so when he shows up in something, it's like, God damn, like David Duchovny is here. Like,
right. It
feels like a treat because he's just not acting as much these days. And he is, he's such a joy when, like, you compare what he's good at, like kind of, he's a really good, like, smarmy asshole. And then that's his dial that he kind of like rotates. Californication like takes it all the way to like asshole status, and then X-Files is like there's a boyish charm to his like arrogance and smarminess, and
right
here is just a delightful take on that character that he plays.
Yeah, I mean, there's many references to Apocalypse Now throughout the whole episode. Uh-huh. Of like, and one of them is obviously Marlon Brando played Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now and famously is super duper intense. So like, I think that's a reference to that. Both Apocalypse Now and this movie, The Hamlet, end with massive explosion, fire kind of stuff. You know, like there's all these things that like let you understand kind of what movie is being referred to without saying mm-hmm. the movie Apocalypse Now. But there's a couple things that this scene brought up that I wanted to discuss. First of all, I enjoyed the delusion of Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Nico, saying like, oh, this is good. Like, people will see this movie and they will realize the evil brutality of war, you know, that kind of thing. And it reminded me of Francois Truffaut's statement of how there is no such thing as an anti-war movie.
Mm.
And how the aesthetics of war movies, the common tropes of war movies, like, are in some ways inherently attractive or thrilling. And that therefore, like, it's really difficult to depict war in such a way that is truly anti-war, because there's some, you get a rush out of it just watching a war movie, and therefore, like, there's something in, like, there's a tension between the desire of a filmmaker to make something that is anti-war and then the film itself. And I honestly think this does apply to a movie like Apocalypse Now. But Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on any of that? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this comes up a lot in video games
yeah.
as well, where, you know, you can have, if you're going to make a shooter that has, you know, a message, you know, it's like anti-war, anti-violence.
Right.
It's like, well, what are you going to do? Make the shooting part feel real bad?
Yeah, right. I remember like Grand Theft Auto 4 was like this, the story was this very somber tale about this immigrant trying to remake his life after he had lived a life of crime. Meanwhile, it's called Grand Theft Auto 4.
Uh-huh.
You're doing crimes all the time, and it's fun to do so, right?
Right, and so, there's a term that was coined around the Uncharted game specifically called ludonarrative dissonance, and the idea there is, so Uncharted is like, oh, this plucky guy who's just going on an adventure, and like he doesn't really want to kill these people, but by the end, Nathan Drake has killed thousands. And he has seen the horrors of murder and violence in order to get his right. Indiana Jones. You know, it's like doing the Indiana Jones thing. And Indiana Jones does kill some people along the way, but his body count's pretty low because it's a movie, because it can be calculated. When you do that in a video game that's 18 hours long, the body count is in the hundreds and the thousands. And so, like, how can you possibly portray this, like, naive, upbeat character when they are choking the life out of so many people? And I think there's a similar tension at play here where, like, you may be trying to achieve a certain message, but the mere medium itself, like, is in tension with trying to achieve that kind of message.
Yeah, totally. And I'd argue that's the case of the overwhelmingly vast majority of war films, but people might disagree. The other thing that this brought to mind was the idea of method acting, because David Duchovny plays an actor who stays in character the whole time. So he's like this psychotic captain in the movie The Hamlet. And it did remind me of something that Kirsten Dunst said recently while promoting Civil War. She gave this interview to GQ where...
Amazing interview. There's like 9 quotable Dunst yes. moments in that interview. She is in her don't give an F phase, and
yes.
I am here for it.
And the interviewer comments on how she's never tried method acting, and she said, quote, what am I going to be like that with my kids when I come home, speaking in an accent? Like, honestly, I can't do that. It seems like something only men can afford to do, end quote. Which
wasn't there an anti-method acting. There was also that in Succession, right? Where
Brian Cox talked about Jeremy Strong's
constantly being like, look at this clown, like, what is he doing?
Right. I think I've really come full circle on the, or 180 I should say, on the method acting, where when I was young, I kind of looked up to people who would method, Daniel Day-Lewis and people who stay in character. Oh my God, the commitment to the art. You know, when I was young, this is like, I'm talking about like when I was in high school or whatever. It's like, oh wow, the commitment to the art, blah, blah, blah. And then I get older and it's like, oh, those people are kind of just being assholes. You know, like they're kind of just being like, they're kind of just making it hard for their collaborators to work with them. You know? And it's very gendered too. You own like 99% of the time, it's men who are doing the method acting. And you rarely hear about women doing the method acting.
I was going to say, can you even, you would know better than me, but can you even think of one off the top of your head that like actively talks about that on a regular basis as their form of performing characters?
When you Google women method actors, the first article is headline, Natalie Portman calls method acting a luxury that women can't afford and has never tried it. So
case closed.
So it's like very gendered, because I think the idea is the fundamental idea is that society is more permissive
right
of white men specifically and them being assholes, and that women, people of color, like they can't try that shit because they will be fired more easily.
Yeah, you know, someone like, would tell them to shut the fuck up and stop.
Yeah, or not even tell them. Just be like, you're off the set. Goodbye.
Right.
You're fired. You know, and so, yeah, I've really come a long way in terms of my perception of method acting, and I felt like David Duchovny being in this episode was like a great depiction of that. Final thought on this: there's so much to unpack in this episode, but I'll just say this last thing. John Cho plays this character named James Yoon, and in the television episode, he makes a couple comments. First of all, he says, I think he says this is the first time he can play a Korean American, which I thought was interesting. Like, often there are these like legendary actors in Hollywood that are like, there's like the Asian actors, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who like, there's like a few of them, and it's like they were the dudes that were in everything. James Hong is an example. He was in Everything Everywhere All at Once. He has like hundreds of credits to his name. But the idea is, like, if you could be the Asian guy, then you were the, if you were going to be the Asian guy in one movie, you could be the Asian guy in movies. And this is during the era when that was the case, right? Like, there was one Asian guy, and anytime there was an Asian guy in a movie, they'd use that one Asian guy. Also, the Asian guy would often die. that was another common trope in these things. And I just love that the episode found a way to comment on all that stuff, you know, sometimes very explicitly, but I appreciate that it put that out there. So anyway, wanted to mention all that, but let's move on. We see various scenes of the shoot. The production designer shows the captain the village, and he's quite moved by its verisimilitude. The director realizes none of the background actors are Vietnamese, quite embarrassingly. So the captain is forced to mobilize all the immigrants that he knows to appear on set and appear in the film. And also we see James Yoon's characters tortured to death. And when the crew watches the dailies, everyone is impressed. Before we get to the end of the episode, anything else you want to mention about the shoot or anything else you saw this episode, Patrick Lepik?
One thing I think the episode does quite well is actually give you a sense of the production of a film, weirdly, even though that's not necessarily, I don't know, maybe that's what it's trying to do, but I think it actually does a pretty decent job of balancing like these characters moving forward in a story and also a sense of what it's like to make a movie, like the kinds of details that you like. It's a lot of this is viewed through the lens of, like, for example, like not casting actual Vietnamese actors, but yes, that's a really like horrific, like extreme example. But my guess is all sorts of details like that, you know, happen on a set, and people are in charge of, in theory, you know, capturing those things or like tracking those things. And I found that part of the episode to be, I was just kind of interesting. I thought that was like an interesting window into the set of a film, as much as it was, you know, advancing the arc of these characters that we're following.
I would say that the depiction of the AD feels very accurate, the assistant director, you know, like what that guy is responsible for, and not necessarily what he's responsible for, because he might not necessarily be responsible for extras, but like the way that he interacts with the director and like what he's expected to take care of, I thought was kind of interesting. I was shocked at how progressive this set was, Patrick Lepik, because I would expect a set back then to be like, oh yeah, can you just make it sound Vietnamese? And like, that's the end of the conversation. And that's, and then the, you know, they make the Chinese actors into Vietnamese actors, and that's what, that's how it ends. Because that's frequently how it's done, you know? I mean, what, that movie Memoirs of a Geisha came out in 2005, you know? So it's like, Hollywood did not care about authenticity for a very, very long time. So,
yeah, I wonder if that is one of the, like, because it's made in the modern era, that right, like, some of that just bleeds over. I mean, I don't know. I'd be curious to see why, like, how the depiction of how was there a dedication of depicting reality versus, like, this is what these, I don't know. You're right. That's an interesting choice for something that probably is not how that would have actually taken place.
Right. Basically, I'm saying Nico Damianos, yes, you know, he's made some mistakes.
Problematic,
but, you know, at least he gave a shit about whether or not they were actually Vietnamese, so I appreciated that. All right. The episode culminates when Nico decides to write a rape scene featuring a woman named after the captain's mom and played by Lana. The captain disagrees with his decision and is fired after having an argument with Nico. While they're shooting the scene, the captain fears that Seamus is going to take his role too seriously and actually assault Lana. He storms onto set during the take, ruining the most important scene of the film and alienating Lana in the process. The episode ends with the captain getting blown up during a spectacular explosion on the set as we cut to the future and see the captain in present day recounting the story to a North Vietnamese commander. So that's how the episode ends. You know, I thought there was a lot going on here in terms of how sexual assault is often used in these movies, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a plot device, or it's interesting backstory for a female character, but it's rarely given the full attention that such a traumatizing event would deserve. Speaking of realism on set, though, Patrick Lepik, pretty unrealistic, I think, to have a... I know accidents happen, but before you're about to blow up an entire town, like, I would think you would make sure you clear the set and have copious announcements and triple, quadruple check there's no one there, you know? I don't know.
Well, especially contrasted to, you know, a scene earlier in the episode where, you know, David Duchovny goes off set to go, you know, track down, like, goes off with a gun that they're not sure is loaded. And they're like, it's a big point of emphasis made of, like, stay on set. Yeah. Don't wander around.
Yeah, don't wander around. Yeah,
and contrast that with we're about to drop some bombs. You know, I can understand. I think the way the episode is trying to depict, I think, is that those calls did happen. People were supposed to be cleared, and he still found his way on there because of, I don't know, being guided by his emotions to having a moment.
Yeah. Yeah, that part was pretty hilarious, and you're wondering, like, what's going to happen with Seamus? Like, is he going to actually hurt someone? But and he shows up with a deer, and it's like, oh, okay, all right, that's
not sure I get it, okay. But okay, sure, fits the character.
Yeah, that's probably going to be okay. It's probably going to be okay. But yeah, so at the end of the day, like, some really interesting commentary, like how movies are made, how these kinds of movies are made, the challenges in making these kinds of movies, the challenges in keeping them culturally accurate, and it's pretty funny how, like, the captain is trying to put in all these lines about, like, how amazing the communists are, but, like, no one knows what the characters are saying. So and there's these scenes where, like, one of the actors says, I'm not going to say that garbage that you told me to say, and then Robert Downey Jr. is like, keep it, that take is going in the movie. And it's like, okay, well
that's you know, we discussed like the surprisingly regressive director. It's like, he is, if he's aware of how it might look, like, oh, this makes me look bad. But if he doesn't know what those characters are saying, if he doesn't know, well, then who cares? We'll just move on with the film, because he doesn't actually want his consultant to translate it. Because if he hears it, then maybe he has to shoot it again and get something else in the film. But if the take seems good enough, then move on to the next thing. Because, you know, especially in that era, like, who's going to translate that and get that feedback to him? You know what I mean? Like, this isn't the internet where Vulture is going to do a write-up.
You can use your Google Translate on it. You can't.
Right. It seems that's the kind of thing that shows up in a in an art, you know, academic book later, and now, and you know, analyzing the film as opposed
to
something.
In the 3-hour YouTube video essay about the Hamlet, they would say, like, did you know that the Vietnamese actors aren't actually saying any lines that are relevant?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I thought one of my favorite parts of this episode that gives you insight into the filmmaking process is when Captain Seamus, David Duchovny's character, is giving Jamie's character a really hard time about everything. Like, you're not limping correctly. You're not, your posture is incorrect. And Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Nico, is saying, hey, can you trust me? Like, can you trust me on this one? You know, like, let's do this and move on. And it's always like a negotiation, because if any one of your main actors decides, hey, I don't believe in this project anymore, then it can really spiral downward very quickly, you know? And I appreciated that even somebody as pretentious and as stuck up as Nico still needs to navigate these egos. Like, he understands, he's not just being like, you're doing it my way or the highway. He's like, hey, I need to make sure Captain Seamus is happy with his take, or else the movie's going to be bad, right? Mm-hmm. And he at least gets that much. So anyway, just a lot of great little moments throughout the whole episode. So yeah, anything else? Really weird ending for the episode. Like, we know the captain's not dead. Like, what? Why end it that way? It's,
I mean, I think this is I think this is an instance of the multiple timelines of the show creating, or like reducing some of the tension that it might be able to generate if it wasn't flashing and going back between these different things. I mean, but also, like, this is the main character. Like, he's not dying in episode 4. Right. Like, so I that didn't bother me too much, as much as it's just, it, at times it can be difficult to just, as a viewer, like, emotionally, where am I supposed to be with this character? Because I'm getting different versions of how the story is being told. Like, it's not even just, you know, him telling it in the future, recounting it, but also we're getting like first person narration where he's telling, well, I wasn't in the scene, but like, this is how I think the scene went, like, which isn't something we talked about, but was like a really kind of neat trick that they deployed a couple of times in this episode. But it's a show that can be a little difficult, but it requires you paying attention a little more than usual because of the way it's handling timelines, like past, present, future. It can get a little tricky to get a handle on.
But overall, great episode. Mm-hmm. Very solid. The Sympathizer, one of the best shows on TV that very few people I know are actually watching. Patrick Klepek, grateful that you're going on this journey with me. All right, before we move on to Baby Reindeer, Patrick Klepek, you want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can hear me and watch me talking, playing video games over at remapradio.com. And I have a parenting and a gaming newsletter called Crossplay that you can sign up for at crossplay.news.
And I just want to give a shout out again to decodingtv.com. Become a paid subscriber. We got a bonus episode about Invincible coming up this week, as well as Sugar's Big Twist on Apple TV Plus. All right, let's get to our conversation about the first 4 episodes of Baby Reindeer.
You say this woman is stalking you?
Yeah, like 6 months, maybe.
Why'd it take you so long to report it?
I think she needs help. She comes to my work, my house. She sends me emails, like, all the time.
Are any threatening towards you?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's particularly threatening.
There's a reason you're keeping her around, and maybe it's what she gives you.
Got really manly hands, haven't you? Chiseled jawline. Should we run away together?
So you're a comedian?
Sort of.
It's not going well.
So is that a question?
Somebody hurt you, didn't they? Who was it?
Martha, can you let go of my hand now, please? Martha, please let go!
Don't you dare!
Welcome to Decoding TV's coverage of Baby Reindeer. If you're watching this on YouTube at youtube.com/@decodingTV, we are going to record this in 2 separate sections. We're talking about the first 4 episodes today, and then there's going to be a separate section at the end of this video with the final episode's conversation. So, but on the podcast at Decoding TV, we are just going to be talking about the first 4 episodes today. Patrick Klepek, Baby Reindeer is based off of a one-man show by Richard Gadd. All 7 episodes are available for Netflix. We've seen the first 4. So what did you think of Baby Reindeer? Should people watch this show based on the first 4 episodes? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. The one word of caution is maybe the wrong way to phrase it, but it's much more than what it appears to be. It is more than a show about a guy with a weird eccentric stalker. I think it's a much more beautiful and interesting show because of it. But it's more than what the trailer, what some of the marketing might suggest of a quirky little guy being followed by a quirky little woman. But it makes it, I think it elevates the show to something much more interesting than I would have expected going into it.
Absolutely. I think the show is incredible. It's a part of this streaming era we live in where there can be a show that comes out of nowhere. Like, never heard of this show before it appeared as the number one most watched show on Netflix. Never heard of the actor, never heard of the one-person show before. And then it is a massive sensation. And it's kind of like, oh, the streaming era has had many casualties and bad things about it. But one of the great things is something can come along just that you never heard of and then sweep the nation. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's engaging with it. This is one of those shows, and it is extremely well-deserved. And I agree with Patrick Klepek that you think it's one thing, and then it becomes something else, much more deep, much more interesting, much more compelling. And I would strongly recommend Baby Reindeer on Netflix. So let's talk about what actually happens in the show. Baby Reindeer begins in 2015 with a bartender and aspiring comedian named Donnie Dunn. One day he's working at the bar when a woman named Martha comes in, and Donnie takes pity on her, giving her a cup of tea for free. Martha claims to be a wealthy lawyer who's worked with some of the most famous people in the world, but many parts of her story don't really add up. Martha becomes obsessed with Donnie, bombarding him with dozens of emails per day and generally being creepy and possessive. All right, Patrick Klepek, I mean, this is kind of the hook of the show.
Mm-hmm.
This woman becomes obsessed with this guy. Richard Gadd plays Donnie Dunn. Jessica Gunning plays Martha Scott. I think this is an incredible performance, right? Like, chilling, creepy, upsetting. You know, what did you think of Jessica Gunning as Martha in this movie, in this show, I should say?
I mean, just captivating. Like, you can't look away from the performance, which it's a credit to the performance because it helps explain the increasingly poor choices that our main character makes or seems to make over the course of the first couple episodes, where you as the audience member are going, bro, what are we doing here? Like, see, like, you have options to get out of this, and yet you keep sinking yourself deeper and deeper into something that seems very off, very wrong. And it's a real testament to the performance that it's like, she's like this shiny object, and you just can't, you're annoyed by her, you're bothered by her, you're creeped out by her, and yet you can't look away. And that's a really difficult thing to pull off. I think it'd be something very easy to get wrong. And the balance between being charming and unnerving is something that she strikes remarkably well, and leads to a just really fascinating I don't know how to call what to call it except chemistry between these two characters, despite the fact that the relationship suggests one that, you know, shouldn't be near one another at all.
Yeah, I think that there were so many parts of the show that made me want to shrivel up into a fetal position or that made my soul want to exit my body.
Mm-hmm.
Just so many moments that are like super cringe. And the whole time I'm watching this show, I am asking myself, why does this guy continue to encourage this woman? Right? Like, why does this guy continue to encourage this woman? And here's the thing, Patrick Klepek, I'm so used to rough and shoddy storytelling that I just thought, maybe it's just like a poorly written character. Like, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense why he didn't continue. Like,
seven episodes of this. Even though they're mostly on the shorter, like 25 to 30, but occasionally they go a little longer. Like, are we really like, yeah, okay. You know, in the first episode or two, like, I was like,
Is he going to continue to nurture her affection for him for like seven? Like, it makes no sense. You know, so I'm watching this. I'm like, oh, this is horrible. I would never do this. I would never do that. I would never and then, of course, episode four hits and completely recontextualizes the entire show. My experience of watching it was, oh, wow, this is terrible. This is cringe. And also Donnie is kind of a implausibly written character if he's going to continue to like continue to keep this woman in his life despite her actual threat to his physical self. And I should have trusted the show more, but I get we've seen.
I don't blame you for not trusting
well, we've
the
seen
show.
A lot of shows where like the answer, the solution is they just didn't put that much thought into it. Like,
well, and especially the show. Yeah, yeah. Right, and especially for it being a show that kind of just organically became pot. Like, look, when something, I'm sure you've experienced this before, something is like number one on Netflix, that doesn't yes. necessarily tell me anything about whether I should watch the show. That is a combination of the massive user base. If anything, probably, I think maybe it should tell you to not watch the show.
I'd say very frequently it's bad. What is the number one on Netflix, right?
And so when I saw this was taking off the way it was, when I watched the trailer, my impulse was, I see why this is entertaining. I see why it's popular. I fail to see how this could sustain without like, it's already in one or two episodes in, like breaking my sense of like reality and plausibility to the point where I just do not understand, other than like it's turning into a murder mystery by the end. Like, what are we doing for seven episodes? Like, this just like that just doesn't seem like it's going to sustain itself. And then, you know, as you said, there's a real narrative turning point in episode four that recontextualizes basically everything we've seen up to this point in a good way, though, right? Like, you know, we're going to talk in a bonus episode about something else, a different show that recontextualizes itself many episodes in. I don't, you know, that can work. That can go terribly wrong. And I think here, part of what I would tell people about the show, if they're on the fence about it, is this is a show that you should trust. That how whatever your initial feelings are
yes.
on where this is going, how it can sustain this, I'm getting tired of constantly rolling my eyes at this guy when he declares, I shouldn't do this, and then does it. Like, eventually,
right.
there's going to be a straw that breaks the camel's back on that, where you as the viewer can no longer even go on a journey with this character. And it's only going to rely on how entertaining like the implausibility is. This is a show that starts implausible and then becomes upsettingly plausible, I guess is the best way to characterize it without spoiling where it goes. But like, it's tough. I hate characterizing it as a spoiler. I hate talking about it as a twist. It's more that I want to contextualize it as trust the show's storytelling. More than, because it is true that events occur that recontextualize, but this is not an M. Night Shyamalan situation. This isn't this isn't something like that. It is more a lack of information about a character informs in a really interesting way why a character would act the way that they did.
Yeah, I mean, let's get to it pretty quickly here. I mean, another episode we learned Donnie has secretly started dating Terry, a trans woman, but he's been concealing his true identity from Terry, and he hasn't shared about Terry with anyone in his own life. Eventually, things come to a head as Donnie can't bring himself to kiss Terry in public.
The introduction of this character in that arc, I was sweating the entire time. I'm like, this is such a delicate thing. Like, you're really going to introduce a character that is like dealing with like their internalized like transphobia. Like, I was like, I hope this show can operate on these different levels.
Yeah. And then I felt the same way. I was like, what? And the way it comes about feels very orthogonal to what the show is doing until that point, you know, because it's like, oh, I thought this was a stalker show. And then it's like, okay, now this guy has this other love interest and she's a trans woman. And also he's using a different identity. So like, what, why are we even learning about this character? Like, what's going on? You know?
Yeah.
And then, so I'm like, okay, show, interesting. Where's this going? Martha continues to infiltrate Donnie's life, befriending his landlady, Liz, under a different identity. Turns out that Martha is actually a stalker who has spent time in actual jail. Martha, Terry, and Donnie all converge on one of Donnie's stand-up performances, and things end up coming to blows. And that's kind of the end of episode three, as far as I can recall. But all of Donnie's stand-up performances are incredible. They're just, I mean, actual physical pain watching them. It's exquisite. You know, there's a term I've heard used, like an ecstasy of pain. That's kind of how I feel watching Donnie's stand-up performances. They are all uniformly bad. And even when they're not bad, something bad happens during them. You know, like, I thought they were just, yeah, wonderful in that way.
I know you're a big appreciator of comedy. I know most of what you watch, I don't know if most of what you watch are like the specials and like stuff that's aired where comedians are mostly working through kind of like finished material. When Katie and I, my wife and I lived in LA, we had a chance to go to the Upright Citizens Brigade that was near like the Scientology building. UCB defined my sense of comedy in high school. That Comedy Central 3-season show is like some of my favorite comedy of all time. And so when I lived there, like the idea that I could go see people like Matt Besser and others in person was like a dream come true. Yeah. And so we got occasionally there, like the show, shows on like Saturday night, it was called ASCAP, and they wouldn't announce who was showing up. And sometimes you would get, the way ASCAP worked was like a comedian or an actor would come through and they would tell a story, they would tell some jokes, and then a bunch of improv artists would then do skits based on that. And sometimes you'd have comedians come through. Like one time Aziz Asnari came through thank you. And he started off by saying, "Hey, I'm working on material. It's okay if you don't laugh." Like, and he's like, "By the way, I'm going to tell a joke and then we're going to get really uncomfortable for a couple minutes because I'm going to spend a couple minutes taking notes on the joke." He's like, "Because you're here and you only paid $5 for this show."
Right.
He's like, "This is for the tour that I'm doing." He's like, "But I'm using you to work on this material and it's okay that it's uncomfortable and it's okay to not laugh." And so there'd be like bits where he'd like go halfway through a joke and he's like, "Well, that's not really working." And he would stop and like take notes on it. It was just a very fascinating room to be in. And so watching, like, part of what I think what is really fascinating about these sections of the episode, they really reminded me of like so much of what most people's exposure to a lot of art, right? But comedy especially, are like kind of finished products, but like the journey to making something funny or interesting, like the rough draft process, is fucking excruciating and usually involves being very bad for a very long time until you can figure out something interesting to say.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is Donnie Dunn should have just been much more clear about his creative process and that would have been solved everything. It'd have been like, "Hey, this might be bad." So, but anyway, yeah, fascinating thing to witness, Patrick Klepek, like to witness a creative process of work, and that's one of the special things about stand up comedy is, you as the audience, you are often part. If you're not in the crowd work, you're often part of the actual creative process of helping somebody refine their jokes. There's not really a medium that works like that. Yes, there's test screenings in movies, but like then you put the movie out and then and that is the way it is.
It's
for
not
most
in real
people.
Time, like yeah, in the yeah. way that it's fascinating in that regard.
Okay. By the way, my wife and I watched the first four episodes of Baby Randy together and she said, Terry, the trans woman is supposed to be a therapist as well, I believe. Mm-hmm. Right. And, I'm just going to, I don't want to judge, but based on her actions, doesn't seem like the greatest therapist. I'm going to put that out there. Like, I don't know about her ability to diffuse and de-escalate, based on what we've seen of that character. Anyway, in episode 4, we flash back to Donnie's time as someone trying to make it big in Edinburgh. I think it was the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
I believe so, yeah.
Which is like a huge deal. Like it's one of the premier festivals of its kind in the world. In a chance encounter, he meets Darian, a successful television writer who starts grooming him with drugs and the promise of career mentorship. We witness how Darian ends up violently assaulting Donnie and how Donnie is psychologically scarred by the entire process, questioning his sexuality and ultimately leading him to the place where he is, to some degree, taking steps to keep Martha, his stalker, in his life. So that is what happens in episode 4. Obviously, we're going to be discussing this plot point and sexual assault a little bit in this upcoming segment. So just letting you know in case that's something you want to be aware of. But this episode was a massive emotional gut punch, Patrick Klepek. It's extremely well executed, I thought. Not even just from a script perspective, from an acting perspective, but just from a like a in terms of the cinematography, just like drawing you into this world where like a lot of close-up shots on Donnie's face where you're experiencing his horror at the situation, his anguish, his physical pain. Totally harrowing and upsetting. What was your reaction, Patrick Lepik?
Well, it's, you know, fascinating to have had that conversation about the sympathizer and the way it chooses to depict the film within a TV show depicting sexual assault. And then here, which as part of the storytelling, like some really upsetting events are about to occur. And yet it seems to have been shot, scripted, acted, the whole thing executed with a unbelievable degree of empathy for the events that are transpiring, in which you feel for the principal character involved, and yet it doesn't feel exploitative. And that is a really difficult line to walk. You know, you forwarded me a piece in The Guardian in which there was a creative consultant on the show that like specifically helped in developing and sculpting this episode to achieve that.
Let me read a little bit from that, if I may. So this is from Jeffrey Ingold, who wrote an article at The Guardian called "Baby Reindeer Strikes a Painful Chord for Gay and Bi Men, and I Know Why. Grooming and rape are common." And he writes in the article that he was the LGBTQ plus consultant for 2 years on Baby Reindeer. And he wrote, quote, "Baby Reindeer's depiction of grooming and rape is as significant as it is unflinching. So few mainstream TV shows dare to explore the traumatic and destabilizing impact of sexual assault on gay and bi men. There is a hidden epidemic of sexual violence within the queer community that is rarely visible in media. It's hard to know the scale of the problem when, understandably, very few gay and bi survivors report their experiences to the police. And we know that almost a third of those who do feel as if they were not taken seriously by officers. This leaves survivors soaked in shame and silence. For shows that want to authentically tackle naughty and taboo issues, Baby Reindeer shows how vital it is to enlist the expertise of external consultants to shape storylines and character arcs to accurately reflect real life experiences," end quote. Anyway, it's a powerful article, and I just wanted to mention it before we went any further. But go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, and I that article is like you said is well worth reading, especially if you want some insight into the sort of creative process for depicting such a delicate situation. But yeah, I'm with you 100% on this is not where I sort of expected the show to go. It all of a sudden creates an enormous amount of depth for this character, this characterization for everything watched to this point. And I just felt like all the scenes where this really upsetting actions are depicted on screen felt like they were done with a lot of care. And that is just not usually it's obviously violently upsetting to watch, but to also feel like it was done with care for the events is an interesting dynamic, not one that you usually see when such events are depicted in television or film.
I think for me, I went on multiple journeys during this episode. One of the journeys is, well, first of all, as we discussed, often sexual assault is used as a quote unquote interesting backstory for a character on screen, but it's never really explored, right?
Or shock, right? Shock value.
Shock value. But it's, yeah, that's right. But it's never really explored. And that's the problem with it, is like, for many people, being assaulted in this way can be the defining event of their life. And and everything afterwards is shaped by that event, as it was in this character's life. And this episode shows why that is the case. This episode shows how this event led this character down this very dark path, this very confusing path where they didn't understand themselves, whether they felt responsible for what happened, what their own sexuality was, and how that can all be mixed up in feelings and emotions, both positive and negative, which I'm sure creates its own form of guilt. So there's that component of it. And there's also this component of it too, where I felt like the show was calling me out, not in a bad way, I watched this guy, Donnie Dunn, kind of nurture this stalker character, right? Like, not cut the stalker character out of her life, like, friend her on Facebook, you know, take pity on her when she looked pathetic, and, you know, all these things that I'm like, you should not be doing this with a stalker that might hurt you. And I'm like, I'm judging this guy. I'm like, I judge you, Donnie Dunn, as a character. Then I watch episode four and it's like, oh, like, holy shit. Like, people are going through shit. You just have no idea what they're, you know, like, that's just true in real life. And I'm much less likely, in my opinion, to judge someone in real life, because I know that in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But this show illustrates people are just going through stuff. You have no idea what it is. Like, you have no idea what their backstory is, what led them to this point. And before you assume it's just a badly written character, pause and take a step back, you know, and wonder to yourself, maybe there's something more complicated going on here. And in this case of this show, I think there is. So anyway, just a tremendous episode that like made me feel like made me rethink how I should judge characters on screen, you know, how I should view characters on screen that are going through complicated issues. So,
right. And even just the, yeah. You know, it's the actions of everybody involved, right? Like, I mean, like you see, in this episode four, you see the beginning of Donnie's inability to kind of say no to things, like to get him, like, and like you, it recontextualizes like whole other scenes where our introduction to why he broke up with Keely, like,
yeah,
in the first place, like,
yeah.
Oh, well, she called me emotionally stunted, and then I moved in with her mom, like, da 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 da, and
right, and when, I'm like, oh, you kind of fast forwarded through that real quick, but hey, whatever, you know, maybe the show's just taking shortcuts, you know,
shortcuts. Yeah. It's also the way we tell stories about our lives to other people,
yeah.
Like, what are we willing to share with other people, and what is underneath all that? What are we even consciously aware of? How our actions are informed, but you know, I think part of the kind of genius structure of the storytelling is that it's the way you usually get an episode like this is the show is hiding information from you. And that's why it becomes a twist. Like the show is deliberately not showed you things that it could have showed you before, but now we're going to show it to you in like a flashback or something like that. And wow, like if now I understand like why this is happening. The way maybe Rainier contextualizes it is the character in the story is not realizing their own actions until they realize it's a direct consequence of the trauma they've gone through. So the reason we even have a flashback is because the character in that moment, as they go to the police station to report Martha, is realizing, holy shit, the entire reason I'm here is because of the repressed trauma in my life. And so it's really, you know, it's
You're realizing it along with the character, and there's like a almost like a plot driven reason why this is the point at which you're being given the information.
I'd call it clever, if not for the fact that like that feels a little reductive, given that it's pulling from real life events. But it feels organic and natural, and that's why it hits a lot harder, because you've gone on this journey with the character. They're having the realization alongside the audience, and so that's why it's why I'm so cautious about like calling it a you know, like in the other show we're going to watch, like talk about like Sugar, this feels like a twist.
This
just feels like
you don't want to cheapen it. You don't want to cheapen it by calling it a twist.
Right. And because that's not what this is. And it really feels like you've gone on a journey with the character. They're realizing it with you. And that is just, it leads to exquisite storytelling.
It created so much empathy for me with the main character, because when he, it's such an incredible moment watching it. Like, everything that you've seen until now, like locking into place for why things are the way they are, and what it is that Martha provides him, which is like a very simplistic notion of masculinity. Basically, like he is questioning his own masculinity, his sexuality. And here comes this woman who's like, it's very simple. She really likes him. You know, she's sexually attracted to him. And it's like, and gives him the positive reinforcement that he needs at this moment in his life. And it's like, oh yeah, it all makes it. You understand why someone would need that, and what this character provides, this Martha character provides. I have to say, the most upsetting thing about Martha is that she writes "sent from my iPhone" for
for
emails
that
are not sent from an iPhone. Like, of all the things to be duplicitous about.
Also, Martha, we've dropped it as a cultural marker. a long time ago. Like, nobody's... It used to be because you were bragging because you were buying an expensive device.
Right, now, come right. On, now it's actually, now people actually look down
yes,
on it.
Yes, now it's very tacky to do that.
Yes, it's like... it's like, I have put less thought into this email than usual. Yeah. Anyway. All right, Patrick Klepek, any other thoughts? You know, I was wondering, overall, I think the Martha stuff, there's all these, like, nice little touches, like the misspellings, you know, mm-hmm. like... The user, like, there's all these things that if you encounter them in real life, it would feel super off to you. You know, the username that has like 18 characters in it and 18 numbers and letters in it, and, you know, the sent from my iPhone, and the on her phone she has like all these famous people on her contact list that are probably fake numbers, you know, like yes. just all this like stuff that's just like, oh, that's just, it's the red flags are flying left and right in this thing, mm-hmm. you know. So anything else you want to mention? Any other touches to the show that you want to mention?
So we've only watched the first four. There are three left. I'm like just so curious with like the tonal shit. Like what's the rest of this show? What, you know, after all of this happens in four, you know, it's a very funny show, even that as upsetting as it gets at the end of four. Like, so where does this show go for the rest of its run? Like, that's what I, you know, I think you and I've watched a number of shows. We've been very lucky over the course of this year where at multiple points you and I are like, where's this going? You know, like, and I don't know where the show is going. And that's especially so because of this pivot. Like, I feel like when I watched the first two episodes, like, all right, this is really entertaining. Like, I guess I can see where I know the specific events, but like, I sort of see the escalation of where this show is going. And the moment it introduced like his complicated relationship with like, you know, dating a trans character, like the nature of his sexuality and how he's exploring or not. I mean, it's such a different show than where it started. And for it to have done that over the course of four roughly 30-minute episodes is tremendous. It makes me deeply curious where it ends up. But at this point, I have full faith. To feel like you're in such strong creative hands is exciting to know that I don't know where this is going, but we made it this far and it's been this good and this interesting and this sensitive. I'm fascinated to see where it ends up.
Yeah. I'll just say this in testament to how good the show is. I'm going to start by saying this. I'm very grateful to be doing Decoding TV with Patrick Klepek. I'm very grateful for this podcast. I'm proud of it. You know, it's mm-hmm. one of the things in life I work really hard at. I'm proud of the podcast. This was one of the only times where I've been annoyed at this podcast because I'm very strict about, like, if we're going to talk through episode four,
mm-hmm.
I will only watch through episode four. I'm not going to watch future episodes. I don't want it to cloud the conversation. And I really just wanted to finish this thing off.
Yep.
Before, you know, like when I was watching it, because the episodes are short, you know, 30 minutes each. But I held off so we could have this conversation up to episode four. And I'm going to almost definitely finish the entire series like shortly after we finish the because it's that good. It's really, really compelling watching and worth checking out. So anyway, those are our thoughts on the first four episodes of Baby Reindeer on Netflix. That's going to bring us into this week's episode of Decoding TV. We're available wherever podcasts can be found. Email us. Let us know what you thought of Baby Reindeer at decodingtv@gmail.com. A reminder that next week on the podcast, we're going to be covering X-Men 97, The Sympathizer, the final four episodes of Baby Reindeer. And we also got a bonus episode for paid subscribers at decodingtv.com talking about Sugar and the big twist that happens in that show on Apple TV Plus. Thanks so much for listening. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. We'll see you later.